Good morning, Cascadia. We have a really special show this morning for you. Dave Rovics is here. We'll hear some of his music. He's going to be joining me to comment on America's political prisoners and the informants who love them. Yeah, we here in the Pacific Northwest had witnessed over a number of previous years Operation Backfire and the green scare that arose from that. Many, many people's lives utterly thrown away, completely left in ruins because of a few people with a political agenda of their own, out-peddling fear in the streets. The present time, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, we have countless men and women behind bars simply for exercising their right to free speech, freedom of assembly, and their reasonable expectation that they will not be poked, prodded, or coerced into incriminating themselves. The first part of the program will be talking with members of the RNC 8. Then I'll talk a little bit about the strange and troubling case of Marie Mason. Dave Rovics knows Marie Mason and will fill us in on that. Marie is an activist, a young woman who is facing 22 years in prison. Next, we'll hear from the Austin Informant, members of the Austin Informant Working Group. It's a coalition of people who have endured the Brandon Darby experience. And, of course, how can we forget all of the rest of the attorneys and people who are working on behalf of these people right now. In down in Eugene, we have the Civil Liberties Defense Group, who mainly Lauren Regan, who represented many of those involved in Green Scare and were swept up in Operation Backfire. So we want to get right on it now. First, let me introduce my guest who is here in live in the studio, Dave Rovics. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Chris.
Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
This is a serious, serious situation, but I feel that the best way that we can all face it together as a community of like-minded activists of one heart and one mind is with humor and strength and never backing down, not for one moment. Keep the lights on, because this kind of activity, these informants flourish in the dark corners. So let's keep the lights on. Let's keep our heads high, because although we are in a new era, a new administration, a lot of the same people are still around, and I don't expect that they're going to easily simply shuffle off into every one of their houses they're currently inhabiting, keep their mouth shut and fade away. I think they're still out there, and they'll still be up to the same tricks because they really don't have any other tricks to be up to. Let's see now if our engineer can bring up some Dave Rovics music just to get everything off to a rollicking start.
Tom Brokaw got on TV and repeated the big lie. See the mill all boarded up, hear the sympathetic sigh. He summed it up succinctly with these vicious words: it's your paycheck or your planet, the lagers of the birds. Pete Wilson and his cronies were nowhere to be found. They said big timber is our business, to the dollar we are bound. Their absence was a message, we'll turn a blinded eye. Don't expect us to give a damn if anyone should die. Charles tells her what's told the nation. The battle lines are drawn. These eco-terrorists won't stop till all your jobs are gone. His PR team worked overtime to build up every wall. These bomb throwers and tree spikers just want to kill you all. A man stood at the chainsaw knowing only what he knew. And everything he learned said it's either me or you. His paw lands through the redwood, many hateful words he said. And several seconds later, David Chang was lying dead. Some will call this man a killer, some will call this man a thug. Some will cover it in lies and try to sweep it beneath the rug. But from Oakland to Fortuna, Sacramento to D.C., there is murder in the air. And there are killers running free from Oakland to Fortuna.
And of course, that was Dave Rovix. Dave, what CD is that one off?
From a CD from 11 years ago called We Just Want the World, and it's the death of David Chang.
Perfect intro to today's show. We have on the line with us right now, joining us from Minneapolis, is Celia Kurtz, who works with the RNC8. Good morning, Celia.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being with us. We're here today to shine light on some of the powers and processes that are at work attempting to put young people, activists, people with a conscience, strong political conscience, intelligent people, put them behind bars because they're dangerous. Talk a little bit about the RNC8 and this case so far.
Sure. Well, as some of your listeners probably know, the RNC8 are eight individuals who were arrested preemptively for the Republican National Convention in 2008. A couple of them were taken from their homes in the raids that happened on the Friday night, or the Saturday morning, and a couple others were found on the street and pulled from community events and spent the next couple of days in jail awaiting their charges, and were eventually charged with what we now know as four charges, two of which have a terrorism enhancement, and all of them around conspiracy charges. And all those details are on the website so folks can find out more about it. But we've been pretty actively challenging those charges in the political sphere and in the community, trying to do awareness and really have a really strong level of support here in the Twin Cities, which is such a wonderful thing. Post-RNC, we've been really pulling together to educate and stand strong against these ridiculous allegations.
So I guess this is the question that everybody wants to ask but is hesitant to really approach. Is what are the chances that these people are actually going to be put into prison?
Well, that's a good question, and that's a question that I don't think any of us know the answer to. I know the defense is just starting to really formulate their defense and, you know, getting access to the mountain of evidence that the state says that they have against them has been tenuous at best, and, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of pages of discovery and evidence that are being brought, and it's been really trying to even get hands on that evidence. The state has been pretty actively just limiting access and making it difficult to a certain degree, but that's going to help a lot in trying to figure out what realistically we're looking at, you know. And the charges themselves carry a threatening number of years in prison, but whether or not that will see the light of day is really still untold.
What differences, as far as charges are concerned and the length of time that they might be facing with the terrorism enhancement?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I honestly don't know the nitty-gritty details. Rob, who might be on your show a little bit later, may know the exact details about how the numbers of prison years change with terrorism enhancement and without. But from what I've understood, you know, we're looking at 7 years around there per defendant. So, like I said, Rob can probably speak more specifically to that.
I think too, the more we bring this out in the open and talk about it, the more utterly absurd it becomes. And especially, I think too, in the light of the new administration, the idea that we're still running around twisting our hankies in knots and wailing and gnashing our teeth over terrorism seems a little bit as absurd.
It feels very absurd, especially as we learn more about how they're using the word terrorism and in what capacity, and that we've been doing a lot of work to try and repeal the Patriot Act, which is where a lot of these, where the power and the capacity to use these words to charge these folks is coming from, a 2002 act that found its way into the Minnesota legislature post 9/11, which is now being used for the first time against these folks. And just the way that terrorism is being used to describe these innocent people is just really startling, and I think one of the scariest things about the whole event.
I think, yeah, and if people met the defendants, they would become, it's apparent what's going on.
Yeah.
I wonder if we have Rob on the line at this point. He should be joining us shortly. Rob will be, thank you very, very much. That, Celia?
Yeah, my pleasure.
Our first guest has been Celia Kurtz with the RNC 8, and our next guest will be Rob Cernik. You've heard Rob on the air before, and he and other of the RNC 8 defendants are going to be here. They're going to be at Reed College, as is Dave Robics. So perhaps, good morning, Rob.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, thank you so much. Dave is right here.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, Dave.
So you two talk a little bit about the event at Reed College, if you will.
Well, we'll be at Reed College. Rob will be speaking about the situation there, and I'll be singing, and that'll be at 5 in the afternoon on the 10th at, what's the name, Elliott something hall?
Yeah, Elliott, the chapel at Elliott Hall over on the Reed College campus. And then the next day we're going to be at the Red and Black Cafe, which I don't have the address in front of me, but, you know, it's a Portland institution. I'm sure y'all know where it's at.
Yeah,
we're gonna be
right.
There at 6, and then there's a death metal jug band playing at 7 o'clock.
Oh, my goodness. I've never heard death metal jug band, and it may be possible that there are people in Portland who have not yet heard death metal jug music. I mean,
I'm excited. That's actually the only reason I want to come out west, and to see David, of course.
And yeah, and you know, you have to keep us up to date, keep us posted on the situation. Give us a little idea what's going on today. You almost weren't able to join us today because you did have court, right?
Right. Well, I'm not a mathematician, so I messed up my time. Yeah, I just walked through the door to my abode from a court appearance. The final days, we had some motion hearings, and we have a new judge. Our judge that we had for a few months recused himself, and now we've got a new judge, and she wanted us to hear everything separately. Up until this point, we have all been appearing in court together. So we had a motion hearing today, myself and my co-defendant Nathaniel. Basically, the state is seeking a protective order on the evidence. There was an article in the Star Tribune, which is available. It's linked on our website last in December, basically talking about some confidential informants that the state had been using against us. And so the prosecutor was seeking a protective order, basically trying to prevent us from having access to our evidence, you know, and preventing us from being able to mount a good defense. So we've been in court last week, and then today was the last day for everybody challenging that, and the judge is hopefully going to make a ruling in a couple weeks. We're pretty far behind. We're 6 months into it. Seven of us haven't even pled. I haven't even stood before a judge and had the opportunity to say, you know, adamantly not guilty, because this has just been dragging on, and we'd really like to get on. We'd like to have our day in court.
You mentioned there just a moment ago the involvement of informants. You want to talk a bit more about that?
Well, you know, it's I can't really talk too much about it. I'd just say that, you know, this just shows sort of the, like, you know, the weakness that the state has. They sent in three people from the county, who we are aware of. We all know who they are. Two of them are now sheriff's officers, so I guess they were going to school during the day and then coming to our meetings at night. That would explain why they were always tired. And, you know, and they basically have got them, you know, we concede that we were at meetings, and they've got informants sitting in our meetings listening to us talk about how to feed people. At an award ceremony last month, Sheriff Bob Fletcher, when he basically pinned the badges on two of these people, one of them, Chris Duggar, Rachel Needing, when he pinned their badges, he talked about how brave they were because they went dumpster diving with the anarchists in order to infiltrate us. Well, you know, Chris, and your listeners know this, like, we were an open public organizing body. As long as you didn't, you know, anyone could have come to our meetings. So this whole, like, thing that they were, like, secretly infiltrating us is definitely hyperbole on their part. Like, we were pretty easy to infiltrate. There was a fourth guy by the name of Andy Darst, who was an FBI informant, who recently came out that last month he went to a party his ex-wife was at about 2 o'clock in the morning and broke the door down and assaulted a couple people and attacked her, and he's actually facing felony charges himself for assault and for breaking and entering. So, you know, these informants are traditionally used in the state when they don't have any evidence. You know, you're going to be talking to some folks, you're going to be talking to Jenny later about Eric McDavid, and Eric McDavid's whole case rests on this confidential informant by the name of Anna, who came in and befriended David and, you know, and had David go and basically set him up. You know, Eric McDavid isn't sitting in jail right now because of any actions he took. Eric McDavid is sitting in jail right now because Anna, this confidential informant, you know, set him up and had him talk about possibly doing some actions. All these other green scare cases in the country, a lot of folks are probably out in Portland are familiar with, you know, the big ELF busts a few years ago. Those busts didn't happen because of great detective work by the FBI. The reason all those people busted, and a lot of your listeners probably consider some of those people friends, the reason those people got busted was because one of them turned and became a snitch. It's a lot easier. You know, the government has, the reason they've broken the back of our resistance movements is because of informants. And I think it, you know, it says something when we're so able to allow this to happen. And I think as a movement, we really need to talk about, you know, how do we create it so that people don't become snitches. Real resistance movements all over the world, you know, the IRA, for example, without going into the, you know, debating their politics, you know, they treated their prisoners like heroes, and they treated the people that were doing time for, you know, being part of that resistance movement as heroes, and there was no pressure to become a snitch. Whereas,
and they broke the kneecaps of the snitches too. That might be worth.
Right. Well, I wouldn't want to tell anyone how to you know, treat snitches. But you know, it was. You didn't become a snitch. It was a generational familial type of movement. And here, you know, people get isolated out here in the Midwest. There's a guy by the name of Ian Wallace who became a snitch and an informant over some Midwest actions, who had basically kind of dropped out of the movement. And so when he was approached and, you know, the only evidence the FBI had was one of these West Coast snitches saying that Ian did this stuff, Ian felt no sort of pressure to, like, keep his mouth shut, knowing he would go to prison and be treated, you know, like a hero. As it is, he's going to go to prison anyway, and he's not going to get support, and he's going to have to go to prison knowing that, you know, and other people knowing that he's a snitch. And if there's, you know, one thing that prisoners hate worse than child molesters, it's snitches.
And the snitches are really serving oftentimes longer prison sentences than those who have not cooperated, which is a fascinating phenomenon here.
Yeah, exactly. And it just, you know, it doesn't... you've got to live, you know, these people have to live with that stuff for the rest of their life. So a lot of the, you know, a lot of the stuff in our case, you know, a lot of the stuff the state is accusing us of, again, I'm not being accused of doing anything on the streets. I'm not being accused of any actions. I'm being accused of conspiring to riot. Well, if rioting means feeding people and providing housing and shelter and making sure that people are safe against police brutality, well, there's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people in this country that are guilty of that.
Exactly. And I listened to what you were saying there. What do we do going forward as a resistance movement? What do we do going forward, given that probably, in all likelihood, snitches, informants, will always be there, like, I don't know, like disease and plagues and so forth. But how does the resistance carry on? Because, well, I don't see it as broken at all, not at all. And how do we, in fact, carry on?
Well, I think we need to stop, and I almost swore, I caught myself. You know, my issue, and, you know, this is something I see, like, in England right now. They just busted four people for being part of this animal rights movement in England called SHAC, which a lot of people are familiar with here in the U.S. The people they busted were in their late 40s, early 50s. These weren't, you know, 20-year-old weekend warrior animal liberationists. These were people that have obviously chosen to live a life as part of the movement, and I think something we need to do is, the most important thing we can do is support our prisoners and support people that are facing time so that there's no incentives for them to become snitches. And I think another really important thing we need to do is really redefine, you know, what this means. There's so many people, you know, I'm in my early 30s and I've been doing work on and off for about 15 years. And I have, you know, I've met a lot of people that come and do stuff for a year or two and then step away. And I think it's really, you know, how do we define what this means to be in the resistance movement? And it's not something we do for fun on the weekends. It's not something we do to meet boys or girls. It's not something we do for punk points. This is a, you know, something we do because it's the right thing to do. And so I think, you know, keeping people supported, keeping people happy, keeping people in prison, you know, make sure there's enough money in their commissary funds. And also, you know, with our case, the best thing for people to do for us is to just keep doing what you're doing and not be scared and not be frightened and not let the state beat us down, because that's really what they're trying to do here. They don't care about me. They don't care about my co-defendants. They don't want to really care. You know, they do want to put us in prison, but what they want to do is try to break our backs and keep us scared. And the most powerful thing we can do is to not be scared.
That's exactly it, is overcome the fear. And that's what this program's all about. And of course, that's what your appearance at Reed College and at The Red and Black with Dave Robicks is all about. That's why we're here today, everyone. Rob, thank you so much. My guest just now is Rob Cernick with the RNC 8. Next, we go to Lisa Fithian, who is with the Austin Informant Group. Lisa is actually at a direct action herself right now. Good morning, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And where are you? You are in D.C., right?
Well, I am in D.C. I was here for the protest at the Capitol Coal Plant yesterday, which we shut down for the afternoon. So right now we're outside the White House to protest the Canadian Prime Minister's visit here and to oppose the tar sands project is continuing to devastate our lands to reap oil for corporate profit.
Tar sands is, of course, one of the dirtiest technologies that's come down the pike in a long, long time. But what we'd like to talk about, actually, Lisa, if you could comment a bit about on the Austin group, the RNC group, and informants, and the effect that they've had on people's lives, they're people that you know and care about.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, as this story has unfolded about the discovery of Brandon's traitorous ways, people have gone through a process of shock and fear and and distrust. But I think really what we see now is that the community is getting much stronger and coming together, not only to defend Brad and David, who were set up by Brandon, but to also really look at how do we work in community to try and, you know, prevent things like this from happening again, understanding at deeper levels of accountability to one another and looking at behaviors that are not constructive in our movement. And I think all of that is incredibly important as well. And that's the work we're about right now.
That actually is the whole, the leitmotif, the theme of this whole program is how does a resistance movement contend with these kind of forces? And what you just said makes that sort of summarizes how I know our other guests, how we feel about it. There's these instances where we've been confronted with the kind of the horrible fact that movements are subject to infiltration by snitches who I can't imagine how they live with themselves. I suppose they somehow come to terms with it. But the whole movement going forward is in many ways stronger, more cohesive, and more self-aware, perhaps.
Well, I think that's actually some of the work that we need to actually keep building from the RNC. I know that we have the RNC 8 that are coming up. That's going to be a very important trial for the movement. And, you know, I think what we have seen, and it's some of the things we're going to have to discuss as a movement, is that we know that the government has always infiltrated groups. And there have been moments in history where it has been exposed as a COINTELPRO in the 1980s when they infiltrated CISPIS. I mean, even in the Iraq War, this most recent war, we've seen how they've infiltrated peace groups. And, here in Maryland even. And so the question is there a way to expose this nationally and to take this moment as an opportunity to try and really push to say the Patriot Act needs to get rolled back, Homeland Security needs to be dismantled. I'm not expecting that to happen sometime soon, but I think that a lot of issues on the Patriot Act, if we can expose some of this stuff, we might have an opportunity to push some of the stuff back. And so I think that's the organizing that we need to do related to this trial. We need to do it all around the country and try and expose more and more where these instances of government or police infiltration, harassment, continue to get exposed. And we have to keep pushing back on that.
Thank you so much, Lisa. I'm very, very grateful that you're able to join us on the air today. And listeners, I know, need to hear your words. You're there, of course, engaged in direct action yet again at the White House and talking about political prisoners, informants, snitches, and how a resistance movement goes forward. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much. Take
and care. Before we go on to our chat with Jenny Esquivel, I'd like to invite Dave to talk a little bit about Marie Mason. I was absolutely knocked out when I heard the story of this young woman who's going to do 21 years and 10 months, call it 22, for really nothing, and all because someone decided they were going to help out the government. Dave, can you talk a little bit about this case?
Well, I think her case is pretty typical of the Green Scare cases. And she's not that young, by the way. She's late 40s. I guess it's all relative.
I think of that as young.
But she has grown children, including one who's just graduated from Reed. Marie, she's accused of having carried out a number of arsons and property destruction and such against rapacious corporations that deserve far worse. And she's there was an informant involved and who was wearing a wiretap and recording conversations. And this is typical of a lot of these cases where the evidence against her is really all just about wiretapped conversations with an informant.
So there goes someone's, there goes another life. And in all of these cases, if they want to make it worse, all they have to do is slap on the so-called terrorism enhancement. I really believe that the sooner we get rid of this word terrorism, the only terrorism that's going on is the intimidation and the crushing of dissent, the intimidation of activists and the crushing of dissent. Oh, yeah, we have a caller, just a second. We have a caller that wants the information on the event at the Red and Black. Once again, Dave.
Well, the Red and Black, that's where I'm not going to be at that one. I'll be at Reed, which is March 10th. But March 11th, Rob and other folks from the RNC, eight other defendants, are going to be speaking at the Red and Black. And there's also going to be this death metal jug band, apparently. And I believe that all starts at 7 o'clock at the Red and Black, although I may have the time wrong. But, yeah, just redandblackcafe.org or something like that. You can see there.
But you really should go to Reed College so you can hear Dave Rovics play, because that's an experience. Hopefully we'll have some music on. And
yeah, and Reed College, that's on March 10th at 5 o'clock. It goes from 5 to 7 at Elliott Hall, at the chapel in Elliott Hall. And incidentally, at rnc8.org, with the number 8, rnc8.org, you can find out lots more info about the defendants and also about their West Coast tour, which begins imminently.
Yeah, so let's hear some more music from Dave Rovics before we go to our next guest, who will be Jenny Escoval.
If you got that CD, The Commons, handy, play Burn It Down. That would be appropriate for the discussion about the Green Scare defendants, if it's easily enough queued up there.
Rodney Coronado was arrested for a speech. Tonight he gave one evening by the San Diego Beach. He stated his opinion. They sounded just like mine. Now they want to put him behind bars for 2029. The prosecutor said the problem was the speech. It showed intent. I couldn't figure out exactly what that meant. You can't describe an action, say you thought that it was swell. What'll happen when we sing this? Who the heck can tell? But we don't like the condo and we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, burn on the floor, light a match, say a prayer, and run right out the door, burn it down. This is your part, by the way. When I say burn it down, you say burn it down. That's complex, but we can do it. I'll call and respond, right? Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
We're going to burn it down. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Well, by folk club standards, that was pretty good. But, you know, the enthusiasm has been a bit lacking. So, you know, we can work on that, though.
If you just sang that chorus, then you just broke the law. To be an equal terrorist, now you just gotta flap your jaw. And hey, who knows, by the time you have a chance to blink, whether you're a criminal might depend on what you think. We don't like the bulldozer, we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists, drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, pour it on the floor, light a match, say a prayer, and run right out the door. Burn it down. Burn it down. We're going to burn it down. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
My sister can sing louder than all the rest of you combined. Which, she's just proven it. But maybe on the next course, you can you know, there's more of you than there are her. And I think you can do it.
First they came for Rod, maybe next they'll come for you. Let me tell you what I think all of us should do. Sing the song with me, raise your fist and caterwaul. If we fight together, they can't arrest us all. We don't like the Walmart and we're gonna burn it down. Corporate terrorists, drive them out of town. We'll bring a lot of gasoline, pour it on the floor, light a match, say a prayer, and run right out the door. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down. We're going to burn it down. Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down. Much better. One more time.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
We're going to burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Burn it down.
Okay. Okay, our next guest is going to be Jenny Esquivel, and she's joining us by phone from Sacramento to talk about political prisoners, the resistance, and, of course, informants. Good morning, Jenny. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Talk a little bit about your experiences in the trenches of the resistance movement and the role that informants have played in trying to put a dent in your life.
Well, I guess the most logical place to start is Eric's arrest, and that was in January of 2006. His arrest was actually the result of an informant. Her name was Anna, and he had known her for about a year and a half prior to his arrest. She spent that year and a half sort of drawing him in romantically, as well as two other people, Lauren Wiener and Zachary Jensen. And at the time of their arrest, they were living in a cabin that was completely paid for by the FBI. They were traveling in a car that was paid for. The gas was paid for by the FBI. All of their food, basically everything that they were using to survive at that point, was funded by Anna and the FBI. She basically drew them into this alleged conspiracy and entrapped them. Zachary Jensen and Lauren Wiener both took plea deals and agreed to cooperate against Eric, which resulted in both of them receiving time served. Recently, a few months ago, they were both sentenced to time served. Eric, on the other hand, was sentenced in May of 2008 and received a sentence of about 20 years in prison. And all of this was for basically what amounts to thought crime. So I think that's, you know, the really interesting thing about Eric's case, number one, is that this informant was involved and basically entrapped him and these two other people. And, you know, number two is none of these folks were actually accused of having engaged in any sort of, you know, direct action. Basically, they were accused of talking or thinking about the wrong things with the wrong people.
As the Green Scare unfolded, Operation Backfire, and all of that implies. Two other names, Jacob Ferguson and Stanislaus Meyerhoff, were involved. Jacob Ferguson, of course, his character in general is not one of repute. Oh, I just want to let listeners know that we have a third guest here live in the KBOO studios. We have Dave Rovick's daughter, Layla, and she's been contributing a bit of singing and a few comments this morning as we go along. That would be her. Keeping the spirits of everyone, keeping us all up and upbeat and thinking all the time why we do this. We do this for the next generation because we don't want our children to live in fear. So go ahead, Jenny, and talk a little bit more about, are you familiar with some of the actions taken by Jacob Ferguson and Stanislaus Meyerhoff?
Yeah, I'm vaguely familiar with those cases up north. You know, I think the thing that's sort of interesting and different about those cases and Eric's case was that Jacob Ferguson and Stan Meyerhoff were both involved in the actions that took place in the Northwest, whereas Anna, the informant, in Eric's case, was actually hired and paid by the government from the beginning to sort of infiltrate, you know, the anarchist movement or the environmental movement and target folks specifically to draw them out and then entrap them in, you know, these conspiracy charges. And basically that would set folks up as examples to sort of strike fear into the hearts of anybody else, really, who would think about, you know, not only engaging in any sort of direct action or dissent, but basically thinking or even, you know, talking about these sort of activities. And so, you know, while Jacob and Stan both were involved in you know, various arsons throughout the Northwest, Anna was actually a government informant from the beginning and actually paid $65,000 to do their work.
And I believe, too, that Ferguson and Meyerhoff were paid quite considerable sums. We're not exactly sure how much they were paid, but it is in the area of, I believe, six figures, I've heard. Perhaps that is, could be, again, misinformation, but I've heard some pretty serious sums of money people have been paid. And this, of course, doesn't even begin to touch on the fact that Jacob Ferguson himself had some issues with drugs and that sort of thing that made him, obviously, he himself, a target for the FBI, who would be able to use that as leverage. It all seems to be this elaborate game of leverage being exerted on people, with the ultimate, the culmination of the whole game is to frighten people, pressure people who are activists, environmentalists, members of the resistance, to get people to back down. And it's really, I think Operation Backfire is a wonderfully ironic name, because that's exactly what happened. It made the movement stronger. It didn't really scare anybody. I think that this is going to be a great year in the forests, all up and down Cascadia. People will be taking to the trees, taking to the roads. Blockades will be up, and the movement is going to come back stronger than ever. Anything else that you'd just like to say then in closing, Jenny?
You know, if people are more interested in Eric's case, they can go to www.supporteric.org. And, you know, I think it's just important for people to remember that, I know you were talking before about the terrorism enhancements, and I think the most important thing for people, one of the most important things for people to remember, is that you don't actually have to be involved in any sort of illegal activity or what the government deems legal activity to be a target of this sort of government repression. You know, it's not about terrorism. This is about them targeting a specific movement of people, targeting above ground organizers of these movements to send a message to everybody else. And I think, you know, people really need to keep that in mind when we're talking about these cases, and really keep that bigger picture in perspective.
So Lisa Fithian with the Austin Informants Working Group talked a little bit about where we go from here. What do you have in the way of suggestions? Is there any way that Eric could have been spared this experience? Is there, you know, this is like, I suppose, the, what do we learn from this end of the question? But how can this make the resistance stronger and better, hate to use the word, but better informed?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a couple of different things. Probably the most important thing is, unfortunately, now we have a number of examples of how these folks work and the way that they sort of enter these movements. And so I think it's really important for everybody to take sort of a long look at that and just see what we can learn from the way that these folks operated and sort of how they got into, you know, different groups. And again, remember, like, you don't have to be necessarily engaged in any sort of illegal activity to become the target of this. And so, you know, it's not always that just not talking about things that you've done in the past will protect you or anything like that. You really need to take a long, hard look at your relationships with people and, you know, where those come from. But I think probably sort of on the flip side of all that, a really important thing to remember is that if we're all afraid of each other, then we've already lost. And so I think it's really important to remember that and not let fear guide all of our actions and relationships. We need to really make sure that we're building stronger communities and that we can work together and trust each other and move forward from there.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And Jenny Esquivel joining us from Sacramento. We're going to try next to have Lauren Regan with the Civil Liberties Defense Coalition join us by phone. I have to tell you, I had a little trouble trying to reach the Civil Liberties group, and we're still working on it at this very moment. I want to invite callers at this very last moment that we have, last quarter of an hour, and if we are not able to reach Lauren Regan, we may be able to speak with her. Nonetheless, good morning. Are you there, Lauren?
Good morning. Yes, I am.
Good morning, Lauren. Thank you very, very much for being with us. Sorry about it being 11th hour and that sort of thing. But this, absolutely, we can't do a program on political prisoners, police informants, you know, FBI informants, And the activist movement, the resistance movement, if you will, environmental activism, we can't do a program without hearing your voice. So thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
Can you talk just briefly, if you will, about your involvement with the defendants?
In which case are we referencing?
Let's see. You were involved in the Breonna Walters, and also, my notes are correct here.
Yeah, I was part of the legal team that represented four non-cooperating defendants in the Oregon Green Scare case, also called Operation Backfire. And then I worked with Breonna Walters' legal team when she was prosecuted in Washington. And most recently, I've been working with Marie Mason's legal team. She's one of the Green Scare defendants out of Michigan.
Can you talk a little bit about Marie Mason? I particularly wanted to ask you about Breonna Walters as it's closer to home. But the extremity of the sentence that I saw that Maria was handed is just, that's amazing.
Yeah. The average sentence in the federal system for a crime of arson normally is about 2 years. And Marie Mason was just sentenced to 22 years in prison for her accomplice role in a single arson at Michigan State University. And her ex-husband was the primary informant against her. He basically not only instigated her involvement in the crime, but then wore a wire and not only gave up her involvement in the crime, but then also gave information about her young son that resulted in the same FBI agent that went after her, then went after her teenage son for a crime of spray painting on the side of a building that happened about 5 years ago. So apparently the FBI has lots of time when it comes to eco-activists in not only going after them and imposing draconian sentences on them, but trying to inflict harm in any way possible. And in this instance, that meant attempting and prosecuting a woman's child while she sits in a federal prison. So he currently is being charged with misdemeanor criminal mischief for an act of spray painting when he was 15 years old.
That seems extraordinary to me also, that someone can be, you know, incarcerated for that. I suppose we have very different laws there from Oregon, but still that seems very, very extreme and perhaps in and of itself coercive.
Of course, and that's certainly the intention. Marie Mason thus far has received the lengthiest prison sentence of any of the Green Scare activists, and really the lengthiest prison sentence of any eco-activist in the history of the animal rights and environmental movement to date. Just to compare, one of the Green Scare defendants, an informant by the name of Jacob Ferguson, admitted to basically being the leader and one of the initiators of the series of arsons that is now called the Green Scare. He admitted to his involvement in over a dozen arsons, including bringing his child and having his kids sit in the lookout car during one of the arsons. And he received 0 days in jail and actually was paid by the FBI for his work as an informant. So he walks free today after committing over a dozen arsons, while Marie will most likely spend the rest of her life in prison as a result of her role in a single arson. And the disparity that ensued in the sentences was not only due to a difference in the courts. Marie is in the District of Michigan, whereas our cases were in the District of Oregon. But it also goes to show you that the government is trying to teach people a lesson that if they don't become an informant and play by the snitch game, they will be gravely punished. And, of course, Marie is appealing this sentence, and we'll hope that the courts will correct her sentence like they have for many other political prisoners like Jeff Lors, who received originally a sentence of 22 and a half years for burning the tires off of an SUV, and the Court of Appeals reversed that sentence, gave him less than 10 years, and he'll be released from prison this fall.
So Were there any in some instances they add on terrorism enhancements? Does that apply in any of these situations?
Yes, it has. In many of the Green Scare cases, the federal government sought the terrorist enhancement against them. And this is the first time in the history of the United States that this type of enhancement has been sought by the government for crimes that did not involve human death or injury. These are mere property crimes. They're certainly crimes. There is no doubt that arson is a crime, but it's normally considered a property crime. It doesn't involve any threat to human life. There weren't any injuries at all. And, normally this type of enhancement applies to situations like the Oklahoma City bombing, where innocent lives were lost. The terrorist enhancement not only labels these individuals as terrorists for the rest of their lives, but it also leads to much more severe prison sentences within the Bureau of Prisons and can add up to 20 years to a defendant's sentence in some instances.
Yeah, as we see, apparently. We're talking about some pretty stellar instances of a miscarriage of justice in the name of security and wanting another. But I've asked everyone this morning, and I'd like to ask you too, how does the resistance move forward, and what can activists do to prevent themselves from being ensnared and caught up in this web? Both people who might be entrapped by informants and the people that the government has itself targeted to become informants. What can people actually do?
Well, history would teach us that whenever anyone is a part of any resistance movement or any movement that disagrees with the government in power, they need to take that resistance very seriously. And that includes, having security culture about your communications, but it also includes knowing your rights and fully understanding your rights and knowing what the potential ramifications of your actions are before you engage in them, of course. But I also think, part of the reason that these cases played out the way they did is because we've had an incredibly corrupt administration for the last 8 years that allowed political bias to leach into the Department of Justice, a federal agency that is supposed to remain neutral in its prosecutions of these crimes. But we saw by now defiled Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, that he actually went on the national news media the day that many of these individuals were arrested and proclaimed them eco-terrorists, though at the time they were innocent U.S. citizens that had not been proven guilty of any charges. And we saw with the firings of the U.S. attorneys around the country that if you didn't play by Bush's game, you were either fired or you lost your position. And so we saw U.S. attorneys' offices around the country taking actions that they never would have taken at another time in history, or at least, not in recent history. I mean, for the government to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars going after property crimes that occurred between 1997 and 2001, all of these actions took place prior to 9/11. All of them took place over 10 years ago at this point. And for the government to focus on those types of crimes at this time in history, it's very clear to us that the reason they were doing it is because they were unable to find real terrorists. They were unable to really do much of anything to keep Americans safer. And so they used these crimes to say, aha, look, we've caught some bad people, and they just blandly labeled them as terrorists, even though most Americans know that burning down a horse slaughterhouse facility for a political reason is a far cry from flying a plane into a building with the intent of killing human beings.
It is, indeed. And the only thing that we do now, I guess, is we move forward being better informed, understanding the situation more. And I think, too, that every one of these people is really, in many ways, a hero. Dave Rovix has sung songs about them. We have guests coming from Minneapolis and the RNC 8 members to talk about it. And it has become almost, these are iconic images in American sort of folklore as it is being created in reality, in real time, in real space right here before us. Lauren Regan, you, of course, are one of the great, great heroines in this whole drama as it unfolds. And I have to say thank you so very, very much for being with us today. I know it means a great deal to our listeners to hear your voice clearly, lucidly, laying it all out. I hope sometime in the near future to talk to you a bit about Breonna Waters. I have a few questions about that. But thank you so very much once again. And thanks also to Celia Kurtz, Rob Cernick, Lisa Fithian, Jenny Esquivel, and, of course, once again to Lauren Regan. Thanks to all of you, and special thanks to Dave Rovix and his daughter Layla, who joined us here live in the KBOO studios. I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Thank you so much.
I went to play at the playground to do things I like so much. Run with my friends, play make-believe, swing on the swings and such. But this morning I went to the playground, and bullies were guarding the swing. They knocked over the slide, dumped out the sandbox, took away all of our things. This playground is run by bullies, and they're all so big and mean. But this playground